Welcome to Voices of NCAJ. We're talking to members of the North Carolina Advocates for Justice about what it means to be a trial lawyer, what it takes to be great at the practice of law, and how being a part of NCAJ enriches their lives and careers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to Voices of NCAJ, the podcast for the North Carolina Advocates for Justice. I'm Amber Nemix, your host and communications and marketing manager for NCAJ. If you've ever been to the Wake County Bar Awards presentation, you are familiar with the work of today's guests. Sean Cole has been a driving creative force of the popular annual event for years. He has also been a practicing personal injury attorney, helping countless numbers of injured North Carolinians, and a member of NCAJ for 25 years. On May 3rd, Sean will bring his myriad talents and skills to NCAJ headquarters for the Proving Causation in Auto Trials CLE, where he will present on opening statements. You can register for that at ncaj.com/events. Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Amber. It's good to be here. Not all of my talents will be on display. I was told I could not do interpretive dance at the CLE, so I keep asking that. Yeah, they keep saying no.
Is that the state bar's rule or is that our rule?
I think a lot of organizations have that rule about me. I'm not sure if it's just those two churches.
I think we need to convene a subcommittee and see what we can do about that.
I think there's probably enough subcommittees looking into me as it is. But glad to be here and glad to talk about our upcoming CLE.
Well, I'm glad you're here. A little bit about the presentation that you're going to be doing. Opening statements. Why are they so important?
Well, the adage about never getting a second chance to make a first impression is true. Now, the reality is, by the time you get to the opening statement, you've already made the first impression, and you should have made a good one in jury selection. But an opening statement is your real first chance to just give them what should be the meat and potatoes of your argument, to really let them know what's going on. A lot of people, when we were in law school, everybody thought closing argument was where you won and lost the case because that was the fun part, right? That's where you get to rebut what the other side's saying and you get to tie it all together. But the reality is you shouldn't have to tie it all together by the time you get to closing argument. You should have already laid it out for them so that they can follow it. And they should already have some conclusions drawn, hopefully, in your favor, your client's favor. And so there's a lot of people that say that closing argument was where you could win the case. Most people, I think, now say opening statement. And of course, jury selection are your two best chances to actually win your case because it gives you an opportunity to really interact with the jury and hopefully do a little bit of persuasion. You got to be careful with opening statements because it's not supposed to be about argument, but you can still be persuasive. And hopefully you've laid the groundwork in jury selection. There's really no way to overstate how much jury selection and opening statement go hand in hand. So it's a critical part of the trial.
And so when you're trying an accident case, somebody ran a red light and your client got hit, what's
right.
that called?
Well, that's probably called a case that you don't want. North Carolina continues to follow contributory negligence, right? You know, we might as well still cut people's hands off for stealing. It's an insane, just complete throwback of a law. The idea that if you're at fault at all for causing your injury, you don't get anything. In North Carolina, the fact that you have a green light protects you from getting a ticket for running a red light. It does not mean that you're going to win an intersection collision case. Even if you've got video, even if there's dash cam from a vehicle, or if there's a security camera at a nearby business, if you can see the other car, or the jury thinks you should have been able to see the other car, you can still walk out with a zero, even though you did nothing wrong. And that's why you want in your opening statement. One way to think about the jury selection is that that's the trailers that get on the television and get on the internet before the movie comes out. And then like 3 weeks before the movie debuts, there's a big trailer that locks all the stuff into position, right? And here's who the villain's going to be, or here's what the action's going to be, or here's the real drama of the piece. And so that's what opening statement is. Opening is your final trailer. I want you to close your eyes for a second and think about this. Again, you got to be careful because if you haven't done a good job in jury selection, there's probably somebody sitting there thinking, well, I bet you had your client had his eyes closed anyway. I bet you were. That's why he got hit. They're looking for some reason not to give people what they don't want. And that's not all jurors, of course, but there are a lot of jurors like that. And I've had a number
of attorneys. That something that you sort of have to keep in the back of your mind, that there's going to be a certain percentage of the folks in the jury who are looking for a reason not to award your client damages?
Yeah. And with an event case, it's very hard to get the jury to look at that and say, okay, defendant Jones over here ran the red light and hit your client's car, but he's probably not going to do it again because he's probably going to think about that every time he comes to that intersection. You know, the reality is I ran a red light about 3 years ago, caused a pretty bad wreck. We were very lucky that nobody was badly hurt, but it was bad, total two vehicles. And every time I go through that intersection, which is every day, I think about that wreck. You know, when the jurors are sitting there, they're not wrong. You know, they're not crazy to think that, hey, somebody will think about this when they come back. So money may not be the answer. And I've had other attorneys, a couple of mediators that I like, who describe that thinking as crab pot thinking. If you're boiling a big pot of crabs and one of them manages to get their claw up on the edge and start to pull themselves out of the crab pot, the other crabs don't push them up. They're not yelling. They're not cheering for crab number one to escape. They pull that crab back down. They want everybody to be in the same pot. There's a lot of that that goes on. There's a lot of people who feel like, listen, I don't want somebody else to necessarily get up on me. The same thing happened to me and I didn't get any money. You know, they've heard stories that we can't disabuse them of, where they think, oh, if we give this person some money, it's going to make my insurance rates go up. He's probably just going to go out and waste it. You know, so it's, you have to keep that in your head all the time. But again, hopefully you've sorted some of that out, or as much as you can by the time you're done with jury selection and moving into open. There's a very good case. Harthouse talks about the fact that you don't have to have punitive damages in the case to talk about the deterrent nature of compensatory damages. You can talk about the fact that one of the things, one of the purposes of giving money in the case is not just to try and not to compensate them for their injuries and their losses, but it's also to make the defendant and other defendants think, oh, this was a bad thing that I did. This was dangerous and I shouldn't do it again. And that's a perfectly legitimate purpose. And we've got a great case that says that. And so that's a good time to sort of deputize the jurors and make them think that they're on your side. It's another example of when conventional wisdom may not be necessarily what you would think. You might think, oh, I don't want some conservative jurors on there. I want people who are really progressive and they're going to think like Democrats. But at the same time, a good conservative juror is going to be like, man, you're right. That guy shouldn't have been speeding like that. I might go 5 miles an hour over the speed limit. This guy was going 20 miles over the speed limit. You might find a surprise supporter. And so you want to be able to, when you're in your mind, when you're shooting that last trailer and you're getting ready to release it, you want it to apply to as many people as you can pull in. You want them to all come and sit through the whole movie through the very end. And then you want, when it's over, you want them to have an experience where they want to do that you've asked them to do. You know, for movie producers, that's, you want them to go out and tell all their friends to come and see the movie, or to come back and see it again themselves. I think most jurors are probably going to pass on the option to come back and try the case again. But you do want them to do what you've asked them, to be prepared to follow your lead on what you give them in closing argument.
It sounds like one of the things you have to do is you've got to get them hooked emotionally, right?
And you don't have a lot of time, right? It's supposed to be 3 or 4 minutes. And while most judges don't enforce that strictly, some do. And the ones that don't enforce it strictly, when you start trending up towards 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes, you're going to start hearing some coughing and some throat clearing from the bench and the ever delightful, well, counsel, let's wrap it up. So I'll give you 7 words. But yeah, you have to, with the opening statement, the first thing you have to remember, again, don't bet on the conventional wisdom. Hopefully you've got enough of a sense of who the jury is now that you've got this partially tailored to them. You can't do opening statements on the fly. You've got to put some pre-prep in there. But that being said, it's also dangerous to be so wedded to your original script that you can't pivot. And so the ability to pivot at trial at any point is critical. And if you lose that, if you don't have that, you will eventually be shot down. You have to keep going ahead. And we were talking off camera a minute about the importance of plowing ahead with something. And one story, this wasn't a courtroom. Well, during jury selection once, I poured a whole pitcher of water in my lap. my client.
An accident.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's a good point. It is me.
It wasn't a ploy.
Yeah, it wasn't like Coach Beard on the last episode of Ted Lasso. I didn't splash myself and fake kidney stone. My client was sitting there, and I thought, oh, the jury will like this because the client's coughing. And I thought, well, this will look polite and nice to the jury. This is in Durham County. It was in the 90s when I was still doing defense work. And I grabbed one of the old pitchers and started to pour her a drink of water, but I had to jiggle it because a seal had formed around the top. And as soon as I did that, the whole thing just emptied out onto the desk and into my lap. And the jury just lost it. They thought that was the best thing ever, which it was hilarious. And the bailiff jumps up to help, and the plaintiff's attorney was standing there staring at me like, I couldn't have, how did you pull that off? But I just had to sit there and say, Your Honor, that I knew that was going to happen. Should have known that was going to happen, Your Honor. And then you have to, you dry yourself off as best you can. The judge gives you a 5-minute recess, but then you got to keep moving. You got to be ready to go. When I was in college, we were doing a show called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And there's a prop in the play that's a ring that you have to have. And right in the middle of the second act, at the beginning of the second act, one of the other characters and I reach out to grab the ring from a third character. He did not have a good grip on it. And when the two of us grab his arm, the ring goes sailing into the orchestra pit. And so we've got to have that prop. So we just keep going. And so I'm standing there and I think, okay. So I just jump into the orchestra pit. We only had a couple of instrumentalists, and most everything was done with a synthesizer. This is a small school. We didn't have a big budget. So I just jump in there, grab the ring, and come and sort of wind my way back out and come up some steps that are on the side of the stage. Well, the audience never knows anything's wrong. Even if they had seen the show the day before, they think, well, maybe they added this, something new. But it was a pivot. And it was just, the idea that whatever happens, you got to keep going. If you get an objection from the defense attorney during your opening, you got to keep going. And so there's no way to predict for sure when something like that's going to happen. But when it does happen, you just have to keep a poker face. It can't surprise you. You need to be like, okay, unless the jury and you can enjoy that together. If there's something funny that happens that everybody could laugh at that doesn't take advantage of somebody else, if you're not laughing at another person, they can laugh at me. I cannot laugh with them at the defense lawyer. That's not going to work. It's a process of being ready to pivot and just being ready to expect the unexpected. I think it's the best way to say that.
So you've got to have good material, but you've got to know how to play the room as well, no matter what the material was.
Absolutely. And you can't be so wedded. I've used lines before after the trial. I would have jurors who'd come up to me and said, why did you say that? And I'd say, well, I just got it stuck in my head. And they were like, that was stupid. I got nothing out of it. Whatever your goal was with that, you should have cut it. And I've admitted to them. That's sort of what I thought. But I had it stuck in my head so hard, like an earworm, that I felt like I needed to get it out. So that's the other thing, is you got to not think that your lines are so good that you've got to use them. It's a good idea to rehearse it in front of other people, talk to other folks, especially non-lawyers, if you can find some willing to listen to opening statements. But you just can't be too
witty. So it helps to be a good storyteller, though, right? How do you hone those skills?
I think that, for one thing, I'm trying to think if I watch any lawyer shows or if I read any lawyer books. I don't think so. I watched Ed when that was on NBC like 20 years ago. And I used to watch Perry Mason when I was a kid. Once in a while, I'll go see a movie with lawyers, but like court TV, I try to distance myself for a couple of reasons. One, I'll watch something like that once in a while, just as a refresher on how the jury sees what they think the process of lawsuits are and how your clients are going to respond to that as well. But I think what the best thing you can do is to keep yourself more in touch with regular people. And what we see, when we see it, all this stuff on the news and magazines and newspapers and about people just going, losing their minds over things, and people who are setting things on fire and shooting each other, launching these great oratorical protests. That's not the bulk of the country. The bulk of the country, the people who are in the middle, who are trying to go home at the end of a day, they want to feed their family. They want to go to bed. They want to get up on the weekend and go to the lake, right? And they don't know what voir dire means. They don't want to hear you say voir dire. It doesn't make you sound like a lawyer. It makes you sound like you've got, for lack of a better term, a stick up your butt, like you're just some sort of really uptight professorial type that can't identify with them. Why should they trust you? If you can't identify with them at all, what in the world would make them think that you know anything that they need to know? At a juror in jury selection in Durham County, probably 10 years ago, Mike Holt from Kenny Rosenstrike's firm in Greensboro was defending a case. We were in district court, just a regular old car wreck case. And one of the jurors, I said, is there anything that you've heard so far that you think we need to talk about? And he said, yeah, I think you're a liar. Okay, good to know. That's good content. I like, keep it coming. Anybody else feel like a liar? And he said, well, don't feel bad. I think he's a liar too. And he said, Judge, no disrespect, but I'm not going to believe anything you say either. I'm not saying you're a liar. But he said, I've never had a good interaction with a lawyer. You know, I've been divorced and none of that was pleasant. And like, didn't even like his own lawyer. Most people like their own lawyer, I think. And he said, I'm not going to listen to anything that any of you say. And he said, if it disagrees, and I can't remember exactly how he put it, but he basically was saying, if you tell me something that disagrees with what I think, I'm just going to ignore it and just assume you're making it up. And so the judge struck him for cause, you know, and I was like, oh my God, it's going to take us 4 weeks to pick a jury because every person's going to be like, I think you're liars. But that was it. Nobody else pulled that. And it's the only juror where I've ever had that in years who, and I haven't tried as many trials as I've tried dozens of cases. I don't really know how many, but I haven't tried 100, but I've tried more than a lot of people, well, fewer than others, but I've never had another juror who did that. You know, how do you hone a storytelling skill to use for trial? Well, that's part of it. Part of it is if you've got an example that people can clue into and will be entertained and gets to part of the point, incorporate that in the story that you're telling. But look at stories. If there's something that's particularly big, it is some pop culture phenomenon. You know, I had just no interest at all in reading The Hunger Games. But then I read them and I was like, yeah, okay. And then a friend of mine, my pastor's daughter, was actually in the Songbirds and Snakes, the prequel movie. I didn't think it was something that was going to interest me, but it ultimately did. And you know, when people, there are people who will make pop culture references, and if you don't get it, you may regret it later. I'm sitting here right now with my Taylor Swift Eras Tour water cup. I had become mostly interested in Taylor because my daughter was interested in Taylor, but I like some of her music too. And so I think the point is that you need to understand what's going on in culture. You don't need to sell out everything that you enjoy to be a part of culture, you know, but I think you need to know what people are interested in, what they're paying attention to. If you wanted to really talk about, people are still hooked on Yellowstone. We still don't know exactly what's going to happen. You can't really go wrong with a cowboy reference. That's often been true in America anyway, because we've got that image of ourselves as the pioneers, the cowboys and cowwomen that blazed the West. People like that image. And so you can use that. But honing the story is about, I think, paying attention to other great storytellers. And Taylor Sheridan, the guy who wrote the Yellowstone franchise and Tulsa King and three or four other shows that he's got on TV, this guy has like four different franchises going at the same time that he's the writer and executive producer for. He's a pretty good storyteller. You may not like the story, but he's a pretty good storyteller.
Yeah, that's interesting. There was Stephen King's, I don't know, 1000th birthday or something the other day. Or maybe it was like the 60th anniversary of Carrie. And there was a professor at the University of somewhere in New England who has made an academic career of studying Stephen King. And he started in, you know, the 80s, like when his work was first coming out. And all of his colleagues were, you know, completely dismissive. And they're like, you know, over the years, it's gained credibility because, you know, Stephen King is undoubtedly a great writer and has fueled some of the most enduring stories in our culture. If you want to look at themes, cultural themes that were going on in America in the last half of the 20th century, like history is going to come back and they're not going to remember John Updike, like all these people who like were canonized by the boomers. History is going to like be reading Stephen King, and that's pop culture. I mean, I just think it's so interesting that like so often people do like rely on the sort of erudite references and like making sure that they're up to that level of storytelling. And really it's knowing what people who just want to like come home on the weekend and go to the lake are reading and thinking about. And that's really interesting.
What you point out there is good too, because it's 100% accurate. And when I did defense work, one of my favorite lines that I would use is the Rolling Stones. And I would say, you know, Mick Jagger told us, you can't always get what you want, but if you try, sometimes you get what you need. So what does the plaintiff really ask you here for? What do they really need out of this? And that was a very effective way to hear the jury think, yeah, do they really need that much money? $2,000 is a shocking amount of money. Let's give them $50. But that's exactly right. And Stephen King is a fantastic example, because if you read, I was never a big horror fan, and then I started reading his Stand novels, which incorporate a lot of his other books. And I wound up reading a lot more of his horror, and have then that got me into reading some more horror. But the great thing about his horror novels is that I don't think there's anybody, maybe ever, who writes a better story about putting children in danger, something that really grips almost everybody. Nobody likes to see a kid in danger. And he writes stuff that is just astonishing. There's a scene in Salem's Lot where the kid is going across town to go to the vampire's lair during the day, during bright, sunny daytime. He describes how bright and sunny it is outside. It's one of the most terrifying things I've ever read, because this kid is going by himself. He knows it's a vampire's lair, and he's still going there by himself. But then you also get King writing Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption, which gets made into a movie. Like you said, that's a cultural touchstone. Everybody knows that movie. People who haven't seen it know it.
Yeah. And the professor who has made his academic career studying him pointed out that his genius is that he's always writing from the perspective of the downtrodden, of the kid, the child who is in the abusive home, or of the wrongfully imprisoned, or the rightfully imprisoned, you know, of the loser. Like, the horror certainly is absolutely essential, but really it's the perspective of his characters.
Well, and I think the kids call themselves the Losers Club, and it is one of his, you know, seminal works. The other thing that I think is good when it comes to storytelling, you want the opening statement to empower the jury. You want them to feel like there is a purpose for them being there, so that at the end of the day, when they've been paid $12 for a full day's work as a juror, and they've got $20 worth of parking fees that they have to pay, you want them to feel like there's a bigger reason for being there, that there is a purpose to it. I would say that the two real things that you want to have happen in opening statement are, you want them to understand the danger of whatever's going on, whether that's something that you can really focus on with the system's failure, or if it's something where you have to say, okay, maybe this doesn't happen every day, but it happens enough that we need to be concerned about it. Here's the event case is still something to worry about. You want them to be concerned about it, and you want them to feel like they are a small group of people who can do something to change it. And if you read Stephen King, probably my four favorite books are The Lord of the Rings, Dune, The Stand by Stephen King, and Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. And those are all books that are about a small group of people who are friends who are trying to save or change the world. Or Lonesome Dove's more about just a small group of friends who are trying to get through their world as it changes around them. But it shows you what people can do, what a small group of people can do when they're focused on things. And, you know, the drafters of the Constitution were the same thing, right? I mean, when you start talking about Jefferson, Madison, all the people who were in Philadelphia drafting the U.S. Constitution in 1787. But it's harder to bring out the parchment and the powdered wigs and make the jury care about that now. And it's easier to say, here's a small group of people. The same thing with the Hunger Games. You know, you get a small group of people who are fighting against the overlords. This Last of Us show that's on HBO. Anything, any of the stories that people have a lot of connection, Star Wars, Star Trek, any kind of good series, the Jack Reacher novels where you've got this, you know, sort of giant gorilla-esque guy who just can't be stopped and he's got one or two people with him helping all the time. It's a good story. And so reading those stories shows
you. Know, I've been listening to this podcast about happiness, this psychologist studying the science of happiness, the World Happiness Study. You know, they do that every year, came out, and the U.S. is falling in the ranks steadily. I think we're out of the top 20, and the Scandinavian countries continue to be, you know, way up there. And it's not because it's cold there and they have to stay inside all the time. It's because they place so much value on community and helping each other and getting things done as a society together. So, you know, it's just like what their culture is. And so when you give people an opportunity, if you put them in that room or in that box, that jury box together, and you give them, like you're saying, empower them, you're empowered to come together as a team and make a difference in somebody's life, then they're the heroes, right?
Exactly. Well, and it's the story that people want to hear. Again, as the media would have us believe that all of these things are pretty dark. Things have been dark before. Things are going to be dark again. And you can find the goodness and the purpose in everyday life if you are willing to look for it and you're willing to shed a little bit of cynicism. And I think that's important. I think if you're going to tell a story, you want to be able to show the jury that you're willing to shed that cynicism and you've got some optimism without presenting the story to them in a way that makes it sound like everything's, you're viewing everything through rose-colored glasses. You really want them to see, okay, here's somebody who's real. And if you can't be authentic, if you can't be someone that the jury can look to and say, I think that's sincere. Jurors, I think, can sniff that a mile away. And the crazy thing is, in my opinion, they don't care if they sniff it from the defense attorney. You have to make it work because you're the one who's asking for something. You're asking for them to do something. The defense lawyer is saying, just don't do anything. Status quo, no money changes hands, right? They're not as concerned about that as they are with you because the people don't want to be hoodwinked. People that like to play poker, the biggest thing that you have to figure out how to overcome, I think, is that people don't like to be bluffed. And a jury doesn't want to be bluffed. And they don't want, at the end of the day, to walk out and realize that they've just given money for nothing, that what they did accomplished nothing. And so if they think you're bluffing them, if they think that you've only got a pair of threes, when in fact you're making it sound like you've got four of a kind, they're going to make you pay for it.
Interesting. All right. Well, this has been great. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Oh, thanks.
We're going to wrap it up. If anybody listening would like to come and hear more of Sean talking about opening statements and more of a terrific lineup, we've got a really great lineup for this proving causation in auto trials CLE on May 3rd. You can do that. Just register at ncaj.com/events. And this is available. You can come in person, which we hope you would because it'll be a great time with a whole bunch of terrific folks here, or you can register and tune in virtually. Sean, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Absolutely. I had a great time. Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Voices of NCAJ. For more information on the North Carolina Advocates for Justice and how to join or support NCAJ, please visit our website at www.ncaj.com.